When In-suk Chappell's play Pyongyang premiered at the Finbra Theatre in early 2016, it was still just about possible to see North Korea as a curiosity of a country. After years of nuclear tests and long-range ballistics, after Donald Trump's tweets and cold noodles in the DMZ, that's no longer possible. But Chappell's play provides a clue to what lies beneath. A country cut off from the world, couched in its own alternate reality. Chappell won the prestigious Verity Bargate Award back in 2009 with her first full-length play. This Isn't Romance followed two South Korean siblings searching for each other and sliding towards incestuous love. It caught the contradictions of a country stuck between East and West, and, as The Guardian put it, the soullessness of Seoul. Since then, her plays have slowly spread out across East Asia, and she's returned to ideas and experiences of immigration again and again. The push and pull of home runs through her work. She worked with Bangladeshi women living in London to write tales of the Harrow Road, and her new play, Mountains, The Dreams of Lily Kwok, follows three generations of a Chinese family to tell the story of a Mancunian institution, the legendary restaurant Sweet Mandarin. In this week's episode of Theatre Voice, she tells Suman Buchar what drew her to Chef Helen Tse's memoir and how she approached the process of adapting it for the stage.
Well, it's an adaptation of a memoir, which was written by a lady called Helen Tse, who's a restaurateur in Manchester. And it came about because Kumiko from Yellow Earth Theatre, I think, had the rights to the memoir, and she approached the Manchester Royal Exchange with it, and I was sort of suggested as a writer. So I read the memoir, and it went from there, really.
Okay, so it's the memoir is a massive story of Helen's grandmother, Lily, nicknamed Lily, who sort of travels from China to Manchester.
Yeah, that's right.
Spans three generations of Chinese women. I mean, how did you just talk us through some of the challenges you might have had in trying to consider the characters? You know, how did you approach it?
To go back a little bit, when it was sort of first mentioned, I was like, and to be honest, probably I was an actress before I was a writer. As an actress and then as a writer, doing a Chinese restaurant play was probably what I had always resisted. Like, I'd always sort of been, I don't want to particularly write that sort of play. So I wasn't feeling particularly positive about it. And then I read the memoir, and I was just absolutely captivated by the character of Lily, the grandmother character, because, I was just completely ignorant of someone who had that history and who had made that journey, and I was just absolutely captivated by her and by a little girl who was sent out to work at the age of five, and her very first ambition, you know, the limit that she was allowed to dream of her life was the idea of becoming an amah. That was, you know, that was the best that she could sort of aspire to.
And these are
as a child.
They're like ayahs to
they're maids to usually Western families in colonial Hong Kong at the time.
So it's a fascinating story. I mean, I've read some of the book. In the play, you have this approach of the granddaughter, Helen, who is at present the owner of Sweet Mandarin, this very famous restaurant in Manchester.
Yeah.
And I believe she's been on Dragon's Den and so on.
So she's
a successful entrepreneur.
Absolutely, yes.
And she's trying to uncover the history of her grandmother, and you use this structure of time travel within it.
I mean, the memoir, I don't know for sure, but my guess is that possibly Helen Tse read Wild Swans and decided to write that story of her family, you know, the three generations. Obviously, I had to make it work theatrically, and I had to make it work in 2 hours. So I cut a lot of the memoir. I cut most of the mother's story out. Most of the play is Lily's story. And I also really related to Helen. I related to the idea of, and it was actually written in 2004. So So when Helen goes back to Hong Kong, she's in her late 20s. And I remember when I was in my late 20s, I had a real sort of search for identity. And I think that's really common to people who do have a different cultural background. In their 20s, I think you just have this, just a sort of search for identity of, you know, I'm British, but that, you know, I have history here, and where do I belong, and how do I integrate these different parts of myself. So I was really interested in writing about that. And then I'm really fascinated by what is passed down from one generation to the next, and the idea that we, to a certain extent, we are our mother's stories and our grandmother's stories. So that's why I wanted to tell the play with this, using this structure. But I just love the idea of this modern girl sort of stepping back in time and living what her grandmother had to live through.
I mean, it's a fascinating story, and lot of cultural things that we don't know about come out of it. You know, talk us through some of them, because it's not just the story of one woman's life, but in a way, it's a history of a country. It's a history. Yeah. It's a cultural insight into a world which people are not familiar with.
Absolutely. One of the things I love about my job is I just love research. I love learning about history. So I did quite a bit of reading. And, you know, Lily was sort of born in a time when people just didn't even bother naming girls in China because they were so unimportant. And the infant childhood mortality was so high that people just didn't bother giving girls a name. But yeah, I mean, it is also, I think it's very specific. I didn't realise until I started researching that a high proportion, I don't know exactly, it's probably like 70-80% of British Chinese people whose parents sort of emigrated in the 50s and 60s, they were from Guangzhou, then they went to Hong Kong, and from Hong Kong they came to England. So that is sort of indicative of that generation of Chinese people who emigrated to Britain. And I just remember when we were casting, so many of the actors would come in and just say that this is my parents' story or my grandparents' story. So that's when I knew that, you know, we'd tapped into something that hadn't been told before and that was quite common. But another thing that made me really, really happy was sort of after some of the performances, people from different cultures have sort of said to me, this is, you know, this is like my family. So while I was writing it, although it's very specific, it's Guangzhou and it's Hong Kong and then that journey to Britain. But I wanted to make it as universal as possible. I wanted it, and in a way, Helen is the immigrant's dream. In a way, you know, the granddaughter that goes to Cambridge and has a really good job as a lawyer. I mean, I think that's what so many people that move to this country aspire to. And just the work ethic, I think, is pretty inspiring.
I wanted to ask you, so when you said that Kumiko Mendel had the rights to the memoir and so on. So were you given a free hand? Did you meet with the author of the memoir?
I met with the Royal Exchange, and Sarah Francom advised me to be bold, which was very, very good advice. And then I met with Helen Zay, and she was extremely generous. She just said, oh no, you're a playwright, you know what you're doing, you know, you need to make it work. And which was incredibly generous. And I think if she hadn't been that generous, it would have been very difficult.
So you said that Helen Say was very, very generous and said, do
absolutely
what you like.
Absolutely. Yes. Because, which, you know, I wouldn't like someone to write me in a play. And it was really odd, actually, because Kumiko was like, you know, do you need to spend more time with Helen? And I actually resisted that, because in a way, I think it's really difficult if you're writing a living person. Mm-hmm. Because when you write a character, in a sense, the character needs to grow and develop and fulfill the needs of the drama. And if you're too closely allied to the living person, I think you might be sucked into that thing of, oh no, she's got to be likable, she's got to be, you know, and then sometimes you can end up with a very sort of bland central character. So I, in a weird way, I actually felt like I through the writing of it. Obviously, she was always sort of there at the end of the phone or email if I had questions for her. But I almost felt during the writing that I needed to distance myself from her to be able to write the character that would fulfill the drama in the way it needed to be written.
In the play, you feel that this woman's life is moving with such rapidity and such speed, but yeah. In the book, you realise that this woman has actually taken a long time. Yeah. She's tenacious. She yeah. just has a goal and she does it. So.
No, I know. I mean, in the end, she says that thing, you know, my first opportunity was to become an armor when she was 12. And then her next opportunity was to leave to go to England. So she worked and waited for 23 years. Which to us in the modern is just, to me, it's unimaginable to have to wait 23 years until your next opportunity.
And then she finally opens a restaurant yeah, in Middleton.
Yeah, after 6 years of saving, working for the Woodmans. I know, just that time scale and just, yeah, that patience and determination and stoicism, I just find quite inspiring and can't really imagine.
So is Lily still alive?
No, she's not. I think she died. I can't remember when she died. I think just after the memoir was published.
Okay, but she did live to a grand old age
yes.
of her 80s.
Yeah, she lived yeah. to her 80s after that work of after that life of toil.
But we haven't talked about the male characters. Let's just
right.
come back to the grandfather. So this is Lily's father.
This is Lily's father. I mean, yeah. he was quite extraordinary for his time to not accept his place as a peasant, because in those days, if you were born a peasant, you worked all your life, died young from overwork, and that was it. And he had the vision to want to better himself and his family and just to set up his own business. And also the way he treated Lily. I mean, I think in the memoir they had, they had all these boys that died, and you know, obviously in the memoir she had lots of brothers and sisters, which we couldn't put into the play. But the way he treated her as a daughter was quite extraordinary for that age.
What was
I mean,
the saying
he treated her like a son.
And there was a saying that you use about a mountain.
Oh, the mountains, levelling them out. Yes, there was a man who wanted to build a road south to the Han River, but there were two mountains that stood in the way. But the man said, once I die, I leave behind my sons and my son's son, which Lily told to her daughter and her granddaughter, I leave behind my daughters and my daughter's daughter. And, you know, through time, the mountains will be levelled. So it was just that idea of, you know, you make things better for the next generation and then they continue. Yeah, because to me it was to me the play is about striving and ambition and that hard work that you pass on to the next generation.
And let's talk a little bit about Lily's husband, the Chan character that
yeah.
she meets. If I find that quite an interesting encounter, just tell
yeah.
us. And we have the same actors playing him.
Yes, yeah. yes. So we had so originally I think when it was going to be at the Exchange in the studio at the Exchange we were only going to be able to have five actors. So then it was like, oh, goodness. You know, so we're going to have one male actor who's going to have to do everything. But then fortunately, when the tour happened, we were able to have seven actors. So we were able to have two men. So yes, so the father turns into the husband.
And it's
father
played,
plays the husband by Matthew Leonhardt, who is Cantonese. So when we were rehearsing, just... Because I'm not a Cantonese speaker. I'm not from Hong Kong. I've spent quite a bit of time in Hong Kong and love it. But it was really helpful to have two Hong Kongers, Matthew Leonhardt and Susie Hung, in the cast. So lots of there were phone calls to mothers and things for.
One interesting that is interesting is the story of Helen,
yeah.
which is played by the actress
yeah.
Susie
Hung. Yeah.
Yes. When she goes on a blind date with another guy from the stockbroking firm and he's Japanese, I found that quite interesting,
yeah.
you know. Just,
yeah.
So this is like the animosity between the Chinese and the Japanese.
Helen just said, look, my grandmother just wouldn't talk about what happened during the Japanese occupation of Hong Kong. Like, she just wouldn't mention it. And I think that's that. And other people said, Cantonese friends have talked about sort of their grandparents just having this hatred for the Japanese and then just not talking about what happened during the war. And I think in the memoir, It's one sentence. It's one sentence of, oh yes, and then she was, I can't paraphrase this because I can't remember, but it was literally one sentence of how Lily had learned to speak Japanese because she had worked for a Dutch family who had traded with the Japanese throughout the war because the Dutch weren't at war with Japanese until later. So she'd picked up Japanese through working with his family. And because of this, she'd ended up translating false Chinese confessions by the Japanese. And that was literally one or two sentences. And as a playwright,
those things are intriguing. Yeah,
it's just, but that has to be a scene, you know. So that was that, and I kind of just in terms of the shape and the structure, I just felt that okay, that is a really dramatic scene, and that should end the first act. And then with the date, when Helen goes on a date with the Japanese man, it was more sort of just trying to flesh out Helen's life in Hong Kong, in modern day Hong Kong. And also, the thing is, it comes from reality, it comes from the memoir, but I was always slightly conscious that the very charming, seductive man who turns out to be a womanizer and a gambler and a triad was slightly cliched.
That's so, Lily's husband.
The Lily's husband. That I just was just aware that husband, that character was just slightly cliched. So I wanted to frame it in as interesting a way as possible. And I just kind of, in a way, wanted to give Helen these two choices of, this is the past and this is the present. And this is the, the idea of following her heart, and then in a way the Japanese man that she goes on a date with is it's a very comfortable existence, but this would be her future life if she doesn't sort of follow her dream.
But did you work very much with Jennifer Tang, who's the director, or did you just write it and say here it is? How do you work as a playwright?
So I took part of, I really wanted to do an adaptation because I've never adapted someone else's work before. So I kind of wanted the challenge and the it's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle in a way, doing an adaptation. So I worked with Suzanne Bell, who is the dramaturg at the Royal Exchange, and she is an absolutely superb dramaturg. So the first draft I wrote was a very literal, very linear, very faithful adaptation of the memoir. And I just remember reading it through and I was just quite bored. And it was like, okay, this can't be the play. We've just, we've got to make this a bit more interesting. But I also think that first draft was very, very important for me to just understand the logic of the story and understand the characters and know what their function was and everything. So then the second draft, we played a lot with the time frame and sort of what comes where in the story, because if you did it linear, if you did it chronologically, the most dramatic chronologically, that just before the end it would be her losing the restaurant, but to me I think giving away a child is cuts deeper than losing a business, and possibly the child, giving away the child, was what underpinned her losing the restaurant, in a sense. I think it was quite important for the play to be, to know what it was before the director came on. So the play was sort of formed. So Jennifer came on, I think she read a second draft, but there was still quite a lot of work to be done from there. And then we did a week of R&D, which was really, really helpful. Just for clarity and to know how we were... It was kind of the rules of the world, in a way. So we knew when people were stepping backwards and forwards in time and what was a memory and what was reality. So having that week of rehearsals, week of R&D, was really, really helpful. And then I went off and... wrote a third draft, and then there were notes on the third draft, and then I wrote another draft. But we were still sort of doing bits and pieces during the first couple of weeks of rehearsal.
You mentioned in the beginning that you were an actress, so how did the transition to writing occur? And I've seen you also be credited as a film director.
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of things.
Actually started as a dancer. I trained at London Contemporary Dance School and then went to New York and trained at Alvin Ailey. What haven't I just? I just sort of realised that technically, as a dancer, I didn't have the technical ability to go where I wanted to go. Like my skill was never going to be enough for my ambition. And then I came back from New York and was sort of in London and just sort of doing bits and going up for sort of commercials and those sort of things that you sort of do as a dancer. And then I ended up somehow blagged my way into getting a part in Sean Mathias was doing a production of Antony and Cleopatra. So I somehow blagged my way into getting a small part in that and understudying Iris and Charmian, and then was lucky enough to sort of stay on at the National Theatre and be in Peter Pan and just do some things at the studio, which was great. So I acted for a while and I sort of started doing small bits in theatre, just thinking, oh, I'll work my way up. And then just realised I wasn't working my way up and that there weren't really the parts for someone like me. And out of frustration, really, I just turned to writing. And originally I did sort of do that typical actress thing of, oh, I'm going to just write this great play that I'm going to star in. And it took me so long to write this play, my first play, that by the time I'd finished it, about 4 years later, I'd lost interest in acting. And writing just suits me better.
You're self-taught then as a writer, as it were?
I was trained as a dancer. I was pretty much self-taught as an actor. And yes, trial and error as a writer as well.
So was that your first play that went on to win the Verity Bargett Award in 2007?
No, I wrote a play called Downtown Doll's House, which was never produced, that got me an agent and got me quite a bit of attention. And actually, it got offered a couple of productions, and my agent said, no, write another play and I promise you it will go on. And my second play was This Isn't Romance, which won the Verity Bargate and was put on at Soho. This Isn't Romance is the story of a Miso Blake, who's a sort of ageing it girl, like sort of, you know, second tier model, who's been brought up in the UK and goes back to Korea to find her little brother, who she abandoned as a child on a street corner. And they meet each other. So she's been brought up in the West with a family with money. She's been educated, had every opportunity, but the guilt of leaving her brother has meant, you know, she's just messed everything up. And her brother is someone who's grew up in an orphanage and was never given any sort of opportunity, and is working as a taxi driver. So when they meet, obviously there's so much, it's just a really, really difficult meeting. I mean, she looks, because there's so much sort of feeling and resentment and everything else, she looks for her identity in him, which backfires because she ends up falling in love with him. So it's a sort of very sort of tense story of forbidden love. Okay. The Korean response to it was, it's just a story, but in Korea it just becomes very political because, of course, there's this history of international adoption after the Korean War, which the Koreans see as very shameful. So it has a very different response in Korea.
Oh, I see.
But it becomes quite a political play there, whereas here it isn't really.
I mean, you write a lot about Korean characters or Korea. Yeah. Is that your personal background?
So I was born in Korea and adopted into a British family. So in a way, my family is sort of quite a middle-class, Middle England family. But then, obviously, because I'm Korean, I always had a sort of cultural curiosity about Korea and about Asia, really.
Okay. I mean, of course, there's another play that you've written, Pyongyang, yeah, which is on at Finborough, which, yeah, is about North Korea. Tell me a bit about Pyongyang and
how that came about. Yes, that came about, a Korean friend invited me to go and see a play, a film about North Korea, and I think it was at Amnesty International. I don't remember it being a particularly good film, and I just remember it opening with very, very violent scenes in a camp, and then the woman sort of three seats away from me fake collapsed, and just the atmosphere was just incredibly charged, and I didn't really know why. And then after the film ended, I learned that most of the people in the audience were North Koreans, and at this point I hadn't realised there was actually quite a large North Korean community in South London, New Malden. And I sort of came more into contact with this community and went to more talks and just heard more stories and just really felt like I wanted to write something about North Korea, because it wasn't, this was ages ago I started writing this as well, it just wasn't really being written about, and these stories weren't coming out, and all we got in the news was the nuclear situation, or sort of laughing at, you know, the leader's haircut. You know, so North Korea was always sort of portrayed as this quite sort of jokey thing that no one really understood. But then, you know, I'd come across these people with these just horrific stories, and I wanted to find a way to tell them. My problem with the North Korean stories is that most of them are so grim. You know, it doesn't really make up, they don't make a great evening out at the theatre. You know, you can't just, they're so grim that I just felt it would be like hitting someone over the head with an iron bar for about 2 hours. And then I read about how Kim Jong-il had kidnapped the really famous South Korean director and forced him to sort of make, I think he forced him to make a remake of Godzilla from like a communist perspective. And I found that story absolutely fascinating. And from there, I just found out that Kim Jong-il had had this love of cinema, and he'd actually set up a studio system like sort of 40s Hollywood, and had produced all these sort of North Korean propaganda films and watched a lot of these films. And then I had the idea of this sort of love affair across the class divide, because there's very, very strict regimented class divide, even though it's supposedly communist. Which is not really. So I had this idea of these two kids that met auditioning for drama school, and the boy is, you know, handsome, and he's the football star, and the girl's a bit geeky. And she gets in, and he doesn't, and he finds out that his father fought on the wrong side of the Korean War. His father was from the South and fought for the South during the Korean War, so he would never be allowed to progress. Like all he would ever be allowed to be was like a minor. And then she goes off to Pyongyang and becomes a film star, working for Kim Jong-il's film studios.
So Insook, I mean, you are writing stories about a world or a culture that we don't really know about, and yeah. We're still in the UK, you know, everybody from Southeast Asia is lumped yeah. together in one
yes,
pool.
Yes, we are.
Even though you have very specific cultural and historical identities. Yeah. I mean, are you driven to write plays about the subject matters that people don't know about? You know, I mean, you apart from having Mountains on right now, you've yeah. also got another play at NT Connections.
I was approached to write a play for Connections, which, you know, I think it's just, I love Connections. I think it's such a great idea. And because I'd written Pyongyang, I'd followed the news story of did you hear about the Laos Nine? There were 9 North Korean orphans that escaped into China, were taken in by a missionary, and then they travelled all the way across China, managed to cross the border into Laos, and then were detained in Laos. And they were told, oh, pack your bags, we're sending you to South Korea. And then they were actually sent back to North Korea and were paraded on North Korean television as sort of propaganda. So just when I was approached by Connections, that just seemed a great Connections play, because it was 9 teenagers. Because Connections is quite a big cast, and it has to be for sort of, I think it's 15 to 18 year olds. So yes, but I sort of wrote it. It starts with them on North Korean television, and then it cuts back from them escaping to North, and then it cuts back to their journey. But then that's intercut with scenes in the detention centre. So it's quite a difficult structure. But it's also written as like a coming of age adventure story in search of, you know, hope and freedom. And all the boys had been, you know, the boys had all been in sort of Kochabi, like a street kids gang. So, you know, they'd had to sort of have like gang fights for turf war, and you know, there are a lot of drugs in North Korea as well, so I think the British teenagers quite like that.
So is that on right now?
So that's being where is it? It's being performed across the country now. I think there are about 26 productions going on, which is which is fabulous. It's the most productions I've ever had on at one time.
Yeah, they're done by like different local companies.
Yeah, so it's been done. It was done on the Shetland Isles. It's being done in Belfast. Theatre Royal Plymouth. So it's all over the country, which is so it's great.
Okay. So what are you working on now then?
No, it's fine. So reading Wild Swans, I just became, and I mean, I love I do love, I'm quite fascinated by history. Reading Wild Swans, I just became completely obsessed with Madame Mao. So I'm writing quite a big play about Madame Mao, and one of her quotes was sort of, sex is entertaining in the first rounds, but the only thing that sustains is power. Which I was like, oh gosh, you're quite a minx. I need to write about you. But obviously we know what she turned into, but I just also see it as, again, she was born really poor, didn't have a pair of shoes, you know, had one set of clothes that was sort of handed down from loads of other people. Her mother was like a servant, second concubine type of thing, was beaten every day. So that was her upbringing. Then she sort of went to Shanghai and she was in her big breakout role was like she played Nora in A Doll's House. So I think the play opens with her auditioning for Nora. But in a way, it's quite a feminist play because she was someone who wanted to sit at the table with her own power and her own agenda. But it being China at the time, the only way she could get there was as the sort of sexual plaything or sort of wife of a powerful man. So I think that's quite an interesting story. And just the Cultural Revolution. Yeah, she was the architect of the Cultural Revolution. I'm aiming to get a first draft out by the summer.
Are you doing this for someone specific? Or?
No, so I started it on, I was on attachment at the National Theatre Studio, but it's only a sort of 6 weeks attachment. Obviously, I spent most of that doing research.
Okay.
I mean, who knows where it will end up? They have first dibs.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, to find hundreds of interviews with the world's leading theatre makers. This week's episode was presented by Suman Bouchar and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Thanks for listening.